Sherwood and Duet for the next hour, and we'll have some time, 15 minutes or so, Q&A before we end.
Great. Thank you, Tony. So first of all, I'm Lori Sherwood. I'm a partner at Walsworth, which is a law firm based in California, and we have offices in San Francisco, LA, and Orange County. And we're here basically today. Well, first of all, let me back up a little bit. So I have done travel law for about 20 years, handling primarily litigation. So this topic we're going to talk about today is something that we want to kind of get people to start thinking about. This is full disclosure, full disclaimer. We're not experts in the field. We're not IT or computer experts. But these are issues that we think present the risk for potential liability in the field that you all are in. And so we thought it's time to get people to kind of start thinking about it. What is important in this arena? Where is potential exposure? What do you need to be thinking about? What type of steps do you need to start taking in terms of your business? So I think we're all aware, and we see all the time, companies on the news that have had some breach of their data, which presents, again, the potential for some liability, for exposure, for some fines, whatever it might be. As individuals and people in the travel industry and at universities that are planning trips, or whether you're a tour operator, very often you are collecting personal information. So I, first of all, before we go too much farther, kind of get an idea of people's or where they're at in terms of this topic. How many of you have discussed it in your organizations? Okay. So good. That's great. That's the first good sign. So people are definitely aware of it. How many people have any type of a data breach plan in place? Okay, so we have a couple that do. How many have IT departments? How many people are their own IT department? Okay. And how many of you, or have any of you, used outside companies to audit or assess your systems for data security? Okay, so I'm kind of getting the sense that of the people we have here, it kind of runs the whole gambit. So we're basically here today just to kind of give you an overview, and this is very, very basic, of what information do you acquire, what information do you have to protect, what types of things should you be thinking about and starting to do. And we are going to do questions and answers at the end, but also if at any time during this you do have some questions or questions, please don't hesitate to ask. And we'll try to make this as interesting as possible. It's a little dry, but we may do a little song and dance at some point. Anyway, so first of all, I want to give you some statistics, and not to totally scare you, but just to kind of give you an idea of what's happening or what happened in 2016. So in 2016, almost 1,000 breaches occurred in the U.S. with over 35 million number of records that were exposed. Comparatively, in 2016, there were 550 million records lost or stolen in the world, with government and healthcare being the most stolen, breached industries. So I think we've all kind of heard lately, obviously our government records are not as secure as we'd all like to believe. And from some of the stories you hear, the government seems to be behind in terms of data and security and protection compared to other businesses that seem to be more at the forefront. 63% of confirmed data breaches leverage a weak default or stolen password. 30% of phishing emails are opened. So how many, I think we've all received those emails in our inbox at work where you go, wait a minute, is that really from my friend? Or that looks awfully suspicious. So I know our IT guys tell us anything that looks just a bit suspicious, don't open it. Email your IT if you have one. If you don't open it. But don't open it, period. And then the forecast average loss for a breach of 1,000 records is between $52,000 and $87,000. So the thing is, these breaches can be costly, and we'll kind of talk about that as we go through this. So has the travel industry been involved in cybersecurity breaches? And yes, it has. And we have a few examples that I have to thank Ju for doing research and gathering this information. So the travel industry is not immune. And probably the bigger you are, the more subject you are to a potential breach. In June of 2016, JTB, which is one of Japan's largest travel agencies, had a breach from more than 7 million customers. And it was compromised when an employee opened an infected email attachment. The hacked information included customer names, addresses, email addresses, and 4,300 valid passport numbers. So the cyber attackers used PlugX, which beyond me, as I'm not a computer expert, and a type of malware to get into the system. So the experts called the JTB attack a form of spear phishing using an email that appears to come from a trusted party. So again, important to be aware of that. An example, too, that we have in the travel industry, the Omni Hotels based out of Dallas, which is one of my favorite hotel chains, and they're a great company and great to stay at, and they have some good deals sometimes. And I'm not plugging them, so no liability there. But they had a breach that came from credit card information and people using credit cards on site as opposed to credit cards that had been stored. And it occurred, they learned of it on May 30, held off announcing the breach to the public while it conducted an investigation. Impossible information included guest names, credit and debit card numbers, card expiration dates, and security codes. So it is happening in the travel industry. It's also affecting smaller travel companies, and we have some additional examples, which I won't go over at this point, but it does happen to both large and small companies. So again, something to be aware of. So what information are you collecting that's important? And you're going to hear the term personal identifiable information, or PII, which I just to simplify will refer to as personal information. So all of you, I'm assuming, collect quite a bit of personal information. So it may be in the form of credit, well, first of all, names, addresses, email addresses, credit card information, including expiration dates and security codes, medical information. Hopefully, and we were talking about this earlier, it seems like there's probably no need for any of you to be collecting Social Security numbers. So hopefully you don't have that information. But primarily the health information and the credit card and personal information. You may also have passport numbers. Okay, and most often what hackers are looking for is the credit card information because they're looking primarily for financial gain. And so they're seeking to use that information to somehow either use it to, whether it's to create false accounts and buy merchandise or whatever type of service it may be, or to disrupt a business or to disseminate that information to the public. So that's the type of information we are focusing on and that you are collecting that may present to you a potential risk of some type of exposure or liability. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Ju to talk a little bit about the legal framework.
So the U.S. privacy and data security laws are not, there's not one. So basically, right now, there are many different state laws that govern the privacy and security of personal data information, and there isn't one federal law either that governs this area. So basically what we have right now are a bunch of different laws that sometimes contradict each other, but sometimes dovetail and support each other. We can't go through everything, you know, today because there's so many different kinds of laws, and we're just going to go over maybe just a couple that might impact businesses, and I'm going to go over a little bit of the California law because California and Massachusetts are two states that are kind of in the lead right now as far as what are the most rigorous standards, so it'll kind of give you a sense of the most rigorous standards, and maybe some of the other states might follow suit over time. So California law, there's a lot of different types of privacy that they're trying to protect. So we all know, like Lori was saying, there's personal information that needs to be protected. So what is California law doing? There's a law that's called CalOPA, that's California Online Privacy Protection Act, and it essentially applies to operators of websites and commercial businesses that collect personal identifiable information. And basically, this law says you have to disclose your online privacy policies that identifies your information and that may and how you might use that information, so that a consumer might say, you know what, I don't want to be a part of that. They can opt out of it, or essentially the key here is that they're being told what information might be used and might be disseminated to a third party. And that's very important, because if you don't tell them what's going on, if you don't tell the consumers what's going on, then you're going to be in trouble. Yes?
Is this for businesses in California and Massachusetts or consumers in California?
This is consumers. This is California residents.
Okay.
So people in California.
But is it applicable if you're living in New Hampshire and somebody from California is signing up on one of those forms?
If you're living in New Hampshire... Oh, if the business is in New Hampshire. Yes, I believe so. Because it is a... Yeah, that is a good question. I believe so, because this says California residents who use or visit website and online services. But I think that's something that we can look into a little bit further, just to kind of confirm which laws would apply, or if there'd be a battle of some sort on which one would apply.
We'll take some notes. If you have questions that we're not able to answer, we're glad to look, do a little more research and get back to you. So see us afterwards, and we're glad to do that.
So one of the big laws that California enforces is they have their own data security requirement. So they're basically going to make businesses that own or license personal information about a California resident, they have to maintain reasonable security measures to protect this information from unauthorized access, from destruction, modification, and disclosure. So, you know, there's always a fight over what is the reasonableness of the security procedures that is in place. And so that's kind of where the gray area falls, because right now, although California is in the lead as far as creating these rigorous standards, it's not like everything is spelled out, you know, A through Z. Here's exactly what every single company needs to do. One of the important laws that California has that most states also have is a breach notification requirement. Essentially, if a business is informed of a breach that might impact, you know, consumers, and they will have to inform their victims. Now, there's like different timing rules. Like sometimes if there's a criminal activity involved, then, you know, you may need to get law enforcement involved first, and that kind of delays the notification requirements. So it is important to kind of look at each state and what the requirement is, because in this area anyway, almost every state has their own specific rules. And the rules also apply to, does it have to be written notice? You know, what if you can't reach them all? Can it be electronic notice? Can it be substituted notice of some sort? So once again, that's why it's important to kind of see which state you're looking at.
I would imagine a lot of us in here got the notices from Target when they had that breach, because it was such a huge breach and involved so many consumers that was a large notice.
Right. That Target breach reached 70 million people.
Yeah, and I was going to say, I don't know if you all are familiar with, I got the notice for the breach by the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Right, and that's the thing too, is like you don't know exactly who all your victims might be, because sometimes the damage hasn't been done yet, but you still have to give your potential victims, people who might be impacted, notice, right? Which is why you probably got that list, right? I mean, the Target Corporation breach, that was a 2013 breach where all this credit card information was disclosed, and basically they were sued in over 70 million lawsuits. By, you know, their consumers and shareholders, And they also had some regulatory investigations. Now, at the end of the day, I don't know how much it cost them, but I'm sure that was not minimal.
Right, and we're going to talk, insurance mm-hmm. is kind of our last topic to talk about, so which is a really good question, though,
yeah.
And we will definitely talk about that.
So generally, what would happen if you don't comply with the laws? Well, you know, you can be sanctioned. You can have government, civil, or criminal sanctions. We'll talk a little bit about the federal government law that might apply to some of you operating businesses for travel. And so there's fines, there's penalties, also private lawsuits. Obviously, there's a huge cost associated there with damages, awards, and things like that. But there's also something that, you know, maybe you're not, that people don't think about as much, which is there's a damage that could be done to a company's reputation and, you know, customer confidence and, you know, having that trust. A lot of people these days, you know, you sign up for things, you give your information, people don't really think much about it because they think, oh, well, you know, they're going to take care of me. I, you know, I provided my information. They're a business. They're legitimate, things like that. So that is a big impact that companies don't think about as much. So like I was saying before, in the federal sense, the Federal Trade Commission is the regulatory body that would regulate businesses. So it has to be for-profit businesses. And so the FTC, as I'll call it, they have their own act, and it's a very broad act that basically protects consumers from unfair business practices of businesses, and that now covers also security and privacy practices. So the FTC is not the only federal law. There's other laws, I'm sure you guys have heard of, like HIPAA and things like that, where you have to protect medical information. There's other federal laws that apply to certain institutions like the finance institution. But once again, for purposes of this presentation, we're just going to kind of go over the FTC as it might apply to some of your businesses. So the FTC doesn't regulate personal information per se, but basically what they do is they regulate the privacy and data security environment by prohibiting deceptive practices that affect consumers' personal information. So it has all this authority, and it can enforce companies and charge them if they fail to comply with certain, like, privacy statements that they post in their websites, or if they make material changes to their privacy policies but they don't inform the consumers of those changes. You have to give adequate notice of those kind of things. And the third thing that they do is they will charge companies if you fail to provide, once again, some sort of reasonable protection for personal information. So sometimes that's in the form of, if you don't encrypt certain private information when you're transmitting it or storing it, that could be a violation. If you don't have measures to detect unauthorized access, that could also be a violation. So basically, anything that creates a risk when you're storing, collecting, or transmitting information, those all fall under potential violations. So there was a big case recently, the Wyndham Hotels and Resorts. They settled at the end of 2015, and the details are unknown because a lot of these settlements are confidential. But essentially what the Wyndham Hotel was charged with was basically they had, you know, industry standard security that they posted on their website about their great privacy and security of the data. But essentially when it was found that they actually didn't have very good privacy at all, if anything. So they didn't have this rigorous standard that they kept saying they had, so they misinformed their consumers. That was a deceptive practice. The FTC went after them. At the end of the day, I don't know how they were penalized, but I do know that they have to establish a very comprehensive program, and they have to be subject to audits and things like that going forward. So the FTC can sanction you up to $40,000. If there's crime involved, then, you know, that's a whole other story. They can force a company to provide restitution to consumers, And one of the big things they can do is require payment of investigation and prosecution costs. So, you know, once there is a breach, there's obviously costs involved in trying to figure out how to rectify the situation. Sometimes we have to get, you know, all sorts of different third parties involved, whether they're people you're hiring, lawyers or tech companies. That also has a very high increased cost. So those are things that companies might be responsible with if the FTC decides to enforce this act against you. So Lori's going to talk a little bit about steps to take before any breach, because this is all not all doom and gloom.
We're not trying to completely scare you. The one thing, too, I would just add with respect to the FTC and nonprofit or not-for-profit universities and colleges, currently the way the FTC actual regulations do not apply, and they are not doing enforcement actions against nonprofit universities and colleges. However, there are FTC safeguards that universities are encouraged to follow. There is also pending legislation in committees as of late 2016 to extend the federal or the FTC regulations to apply to nonprofit businesses. So for right now, if you're with an affinity group at a university and you're a nonprofit, you may be somewhat safe from enforcement actions, but it's something you kind of want to keep track of, and we'll see how the law plays out. But now to try to give you some practical tips for what you can do. So I'm going to kind of break this down into five sections. Number one is to take stock. So first of all, what type of information are you collecting? So most likely credit card information, address information, including email, phone numbers, that sort of thing. And you may also be collecting medical information or health information. I'm assuming that a lot of you in the room, or most of you, are collecting that information. Fair assumption? Okay. So the key is, or a couple of keys, once you've identified the information, next you want to identify who has access to it. Okay, key rule, try to limit the people that have access to that information. Okay, it should be solely or really just on a need-to-know basis. Not everyone in your company, if you've got 20 employees or you've got 100 employees, generally not everyone needs to have that information. So really try to limit who has access to that information. You should also have a person who is in charge of tracking that information. Now, some of you, I understand, may be smaller, so it may fall to one person to kind of do everything with regard to that information. If you're a bigger organization, then you may have someone specifically that's in charge of that and is handling that. But again, and then also assess, how do you receive that information? Hopefully it's coming in on some type of a protected line. If you are sharing that information with any other agencies, that information really should be encrypted, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. Okay, so number two, scale down. So basically, try to keep that information, especially credit card information, and specifically expiration dates and security codes, only as long as you need it. Okay, so once a trip is over, unless there's some dire reason to keep that information, get rid of it. And I would recommend, you know, and that doesn't mean just taking a piece of paper and throwing it in the trash, that you've written down somebody's credit card information. If it's electronically obtained, make sure you have a good measure to get rid of it. If it's paper information, be sure that information is shredded. Okay, don't just go throw it in the trash. The same would also apply to medical information, although we had a good question come up yesterday in another session. What about medical information and the potential for, if there was a problem on a trip, there's the potential for some type of claim or lawsuit, And you're looking at a potential statute of limitations issue. So on a very basic level, generally, and it depends and it varies from state to state, but if you have an accident on a trip for, say, in California, and it's a California resident or the suit is being brought in California, you have 2 years to file a lawsuit. It's possible that medical questionnaire may contain information that would form part of or all of a defense for you. So that information you would probably want to maintain at least until 2 years after the trip to protect yourself. But again, medical information in particular should be whoever has access to that should be very, very limited. And I know the other issue that's come up with, and although it's not related to the cybersecurity issue, is just the HIPAA question with respect to medical information. So generally, HIPAA applies to insurance companies, it applies to medical providers. I could say generally does not apply to a travel company. However, if you start sharing that information with other people, and with, say, for example, you want an outside doctor to look, you've got a concern about a client who wants to go on a trip and you have concern about their medical information. You either want to make sure that you have authorization from the traveler to share that information, or somewhere you have in your terms and conditions or your legal documents that you have authority to share that with X individuals as necessary, so at least people are on notice. But again, it is, I think, common sense. It is people's private medical information. It may be very critical for certain people to have, but be careful about who it's being shared with, what disclosures you're making to the traveler. Sure. Right, and so again, not being a total tech person, I would probably maybe print out the document, and again, not a disclaimer here, but possibly print out that document, then have it scanned, encoded, or somehow protected, delete the email and advise, and then respond to in a separate email to the traveler to not just, you know, send information that way.
Mm-hmm. How important would it be to do that for passport information? And also, we work with a bank. Our bank is very sensitive to fraud, and yet they, of course, want us to bank online and transmit information online. We actually don't because we think via target and other things.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I know I personally even, like last week I needed to give my secretary or assistant my credit card number, and I said, I will just call you and give it to you because I don't want to email it. I would think, I mean, that your banking institutions would somehow have encrypted, in some type of encrypted method for you to provide that information so that you're not just providing it in an email saying, here's all of our travelers and here's their credit card information and please charge their trips. But I would think that they would want to have some type of security measures in place to protect themselves because they're a receiver of that information.
You'd want to protect as much as you can. You know, a
passport information in some states is considered, you know, personal identifiable information that you have to protect. In other states, it's not. But once again, you know, it's not all congruent right now. So I think the theme is sort of, you know, be safe.
Yeah, and I think with passport numbers, it can potentially, like a driver's license number, lead to other sources of information. We know that criminals that are doing this type of hacking, they're good at what they do, and they're capable of taking that information then to somehow lead to other information. So I think it's always, it's better to err on the side of caution, I think. And I expect because this is becoming such an issue in the forefront, there will continue to be more and more regulation. And we obviously live in much more of a cyber and internet and electronic world, so that it does beg more potential exposure. Okay, so step three, lock it. So protect the information that you keep. And just, I have a few just tips that I will kind of go through to give you just some general guidance. So it's a good idea not to store sensitive consumer data on any computer that has an internet connection unless it's essential to conducting your business. Encrypt sensitive information that you send to third parties over public networks. So if you are forwarding on, which is the question just asked, if you're forwarding information to a third party, so whether it be to a financial institution, whether it be medical information to your tour operator, you know, maybe your tour operator's collecting that information themselves, but it should be done on an encrypted network or encrypted information. Regularly run up-to-date malware programs on individual computers and on servers on your network. And again, if you have an IT department, hopefully they are doing that. I know we do a fair amount of work for various insurance companies, and some of them are requiring that we have certain systems in place in order to do work with them that protects the information we get. We tend to handle a fair number of public or personal injury type claims, either in travel or other fields. And a lot of times you're getting a lot of medical information. So again, they want to make sure that we're protecting that information because as an insurance company, they have some duties with respect to that information. Restrict employees' ability to download unauthorized software. Scan computers on your network to identify and profile the operating system and open network services. When you receive or transmit credit card information or other sensitive financial data, use, and this is just some general information we actually got, I think, through the DOJ and some other sources, but use transport layer security encryption or another secure connection. Pay particular attention to the security of your web applications. Use strong passwords and/or authentication, and also require your employees to change passwords periodically. I think the password issue, as Ju mentioned, is becoming a bigger and bigger issue, and the strength of passwords is obviously very, very important. I know we all have so many passwords, I think, floating around in our heads, it's hard to keep track, and we tend to use the same ones over and over again for a number of variety of sources we deal with, which probably isn't always the smartest thing, but I think sometimes it's the easiest. So just another tack to remember. Firewalls, you should have firewalls in place to protect your systems. You should have some type of method to detect a breach if and hopefully it doesn't occur, but if it occurs, there are intrusion detection systems that are available. And again, this goes back to an IT question. And if you don't, probably just kind of a word of advice, if you're not big enough, you don't have an IT department, it may be worth the money to spend to have somebody come in and audit your system and make sure you have all the protections in place you should have. I think there are a variety of services or companies that provide that service. Honestly, I don't know what the cost is entailed, and I think it would vary from size of company and to the services you need it, but it may well be worth the investment up front to be proactive as opposed to getting caught on the back end. And then take the time to train your employees. Okay, so make sure your employees who have access to that information understand the responsibility, how they should handle the information, if they're the ones forwarding it, how they should be dealing with it. But training is, it's important to train your employees. Okay, and I already kind of mentioned this, but number four is pitch it. So when you no longer need it, get rid of it, but get rid of it safely. The statute of limitations issue, just something to keep in mind. If you've had a problem on a trip or any complaints or, you know, a particular traveler that you may be concerned about. And then plan ahead. So be sure to have a plan in place to respond to incidents when they occur. And Ju's going to talk about that a little bit more in detail. But it should be a written plan that you have for your company. There should be somebody identified to be responsible for implementing and working with that plan. If, and hopefully it doesn't happen, but in case you do have a data breach. So with that, I'll turn it over back to Ju to talk a little bit about plans.
So essentially, the hope is that a company has some sort of plan in place to respond to a breach. So I'm going to kind of go over just a few steps of what a company should do. And this is best practices that that's found on the Department of Justice website, and we're putting that up on
the dashboard,
and it should already be there. If it's not, we'll just make sure that it is there. And it's the DOJ sort of best practices. What steps should you take if there is a breach? The number one thing is have a plan before the breach happens. But you know, let's say the breach occurs, what do you do? Well, the first thing you do, number one, is you assess the nature and scope of the incident. This is essentially kind of what it sounds. You know, what happened? You want to determine which computers, what systems were affected. You got to figure out the origin of the attack. You know, was malware used? Was it a phishing email? And you want to also identify any remote servers, if you have that sort of capacity, to see if data was sent to them. And a very important thing is you want to identify the potential victims that might be, impacted by the breach. The important thing you want to consider is, how do I preserve any of the communications that relates to the incident? So the communications in this respect relates to if there was any, like, threatening emails, there's any extortion-type demands. I don't know if you guys have heard of, like, ransomware-type things, but that would be, like, an extortion-type demand. Or anything just suspicious. Those are all the kind of communications you want to preserve. If you're not sure, preserve it. And you don't want to delete any files, or you don't want to delete anything that relates to the potential impacted systems or computers. Or documents or files. You want to next, number two, implement some sort of measure to minimize the continuing damage. So this is also an IT issue, and it's going to be case specific. But to minimize the continuing damage, you may need to reroute some sort of network traffic. You may need to filter or implement blocking some sort of attack. You may need to isolate parts of the compromised network. And once again, this is a theme, is you want to document everything. You want to make sure you have detailed records of what you did to mitigate the situation. And that'll help along the line if there is any litigation or some sort of enforcement action taken against you. Number three is you want to, and it kind of goes with number two, you want to try to record and collect the information related to the attack. The DOJ says the best case scenario would be to image the computer or the system that's been impacted. Imaging is really expensive. It could be really expensive, and I know a lot of companies may not have that capacity. Depending on the size of the attack, you may want to consider hiring some sort of forensic computer people to take a look at that, and they can also give you like an estimate on what it might cost. I represented a hotel recently where we had to image the entire systems to make sure that there was no tampering of some sort of evidence. And I know that we had to get a forensic computer people on board, and they were so helpful with providing, you know, estimates and things like that, but it is very expensive. So depending on the size of the attack and, you know, what's at stake, you may want to consider that. You may want to also make sure that people involved, they're all taking notes. They're keeping their notes if they have any. Even if it's something that might seem minor, this is all stuff that could be very important at the end of the day. So you don't want to underestimate people's notes when it relates to, you know, handling the attack or trying to mitigate the attack. Number four is you want to notify. So you want to first notify people in your organization of what happened, because you, and this may include management or IT or your attorneys or somebody, because you have to make sure that, like Lori said, when you plan ahead, each person, there should be people identified as to what each person should be doing, and in order to you know, identify the specific people who are going to be involved in mitigating the circumstances, you want to plan ahead and make sure you know who those people are. A lot of situations may require you to consider contacting law enforcement, especially if there's kind of a question of whether there was a crime involved. And also, contacting law enforcement could be helpful because they have resources and things like that that you may not. They may also help you figure out the best way to notify your the other victims that could be involved. The DOJ also talked about notifying Homeland Security, because now Homeland Security has a separate cyber community and cyber organization that kind of collects all this information, follows it, and, you know, I think they cross-reference to make you know, to figure out if there's any cyber attacks that are super common or impacting certain industries. So that is something that DAJ also talked about. And finally, there's a couple do nots. You know, you don't want to use your compromised system. That's just not a good idea. You also don't want to seek revenge. You know, let's say that you find out who did the attack. Don't go and hack them because you're angry. That could lead to the same problems that they're going to face. You're going to have to face them too, whether that's criminal, civil, or whatever penalties. So try not to do that. And like most things, when an incident occurs, whether it's cyber breach or otherwise, you always want to assess how it happened and what steps were taken and what you want to do to improve, sort of like any other sort of incident that would occur in your company. So those are sort of the steps you want to take. Once again, we'll make sure the DOJ article is on there, because it is a very good narrative, and it kind of lays out the steps pretty well.
Okay, and just, I got the high sign on time, so I just quickly want to talk a little bit about what can you do to protect yourself other than kind of the things that we've talked about. One issue we're looking into, and I don't have a definitive answer yet, but is it possible to put some type of language regarding the collection of that material in your terms and conditions and trying to somewhat limit your potential liability and exposure? So we will have your contact information, you'll have ours, so we will continue to kind of look at that issue as to whether can you somehow try to limit your liability. I also think, to the extent that maybe you are providing this information to third parties or to tour operators and you have an agreement with that tour operator, you may want to look at possibly including some type of indemnity language for the handling of that information by the tour operator, so that if there is a breach that results on the part of the tour operator, that they will indemnify, defend, and hold you harmless for that breach, because they're now the ones handling that information. And the last thing, just to briefly mention, so Kathy asked a great question about, does your general liability insurance policy cover this type of breach? Does your E&O, does your general liability cover it? Generally, no. Okay, and there was a big case, I believe, with, I want to say Macy's, or there was some, let's see, I forgot off the top of my... With Sony, where Sony tried to say, hey, our CGL policy should cover it, and the court said no. And they spent a lot of time working out and disputing and trying to deal with those coverage issues. There now is available cybersecurity or cyber liability insurance through a various number of providers. Generally, it does tend to be fairly costly, and I think, again, it depends on the size of the company and the potential risk. But it does cover liability for security or privacy breaches, which includes the loss of confidential information or failing to prevent that. It can also cover the costs associated with the breach, so have to hire outside investigators, auditing companies, and that type of thing. And also, if you're a lot of companies, as we've seen, will provide them the credit reporting services access. Cyber liability insurance would cover that. It could also cover the costs associated with restoring and updating data. Also, business interruption costs and possible breach damages that could result, such as result to reputation, defamation, slander, libel, those types of things. So I think we're getting close to time to wrap it up and allow for questions. So if anyone has questions, we'd be more than happy to answer them. You know what, we'll write that down and we'll at least ask our IT guys and see what they have to say. Mm-hmm. More, right.
I'm just wondering about, you know, often we're handling the passenger information, but our sponsor or client wants to have that information. We cross out the credit card stuff, but not the passport stuff usually. But is there a way to sort of automatically or easily send it in an encrypted file?
Right, and I think there is some sort of system you'd have to
or
put in place. Because when somebody sends me something encrypted, like she said, it comes with, you know, basically says you've received encrypted information and I have to, like, click on it and I've got to put in the authentication and then, you know, go through, like, three different steps to, exactly, to open it. So, yeah.
Jim?
I don't know if you have any resources, but in terms of best practices, but more and more employees are working remotely and using their own personal computers and phones and whatever.
Remotely. You know, that's a really good question. I know, so for example, a lot of us at our firm work remotely, and we have, a Citrix system, yeah. And that has to be accessed through an app, and there are controls in place. You know, that's a good question. We could do some checking. I would imagine that there are some, definitely some best practices. Again, it's probably more of an IT type issue, but right. we're, you know, we could certainly find out. And I think it is, it raises, you know, again, another issue. And again, the need to have access to specific information. So do people working remotely, depending on their role, do they need access to that information or not? And really trying to limit the number of people that have access to the personal information.
Right, and I think also goes back to kind of the training, you know, training your employees, like you don't want them to be saving anything on their own personal laptops and things like that.
Kathy?
Right.
Correct. Correct.
Yes, the FTC Act, and it's just basically the law that says, you know, businesses can't do anything that's deceptive, and they can't be, you know, fooling the consumers.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Trade,
exactly.
Right.
It is. So they just use that broad authority because there isn't something that regulates specifically the cyber
right.
and privacy.
We
don't, because that's just medical. Right.
Right.
Yes. Okay. That's great.
Right.
And then evidently, too, just from our research, there are FTC safeguards, which nonprofit universities and colleges and our nonprofits should generally be taking a look at.
Yeah.
But it does look like that. There's the potential with pending legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, depending on how it goes here on out, and I don't know what the current status of that, but it was in committee as of late last year. So something to keep an eye out for.
Right.
Okay, well, we'll be around if anyone... Oh, question. Sorry.
Okay.
You mentioned a website for California Calopa.
Oh, it's like a privacy law, Calopa.
Can you spell that?
Yes, it's... Why don't I actually give you the full name? So it's California Online Privacy Protection Act. And it applies to operators of commercial websites or online services that collect personal information about California residents that use their website.
So you could probably just Google that and mm-hmm. the act should come up. And the California DOJ may also have, we didn't check, but the California DOJ may have some guidelines on their website too.
Mm-hmm.
So most companies, and companies should have a document retention policy, and it does tend to vary from company to company, and it also depends on if any of that relates to other potential areas, whether it could be tax records or whatever it may be. One thing you want to be careful of, if you think there's any potential for a lawsuit or some type of claim, you don't want to be destroying any types of records, as we all know, and you don't want to be deleting email. And it also would depend on what the type of claim is. So somebody might be bringing a breach of contract claim if a trip didn't go well, so it may not just be personal injury, but there may be other types of claims which do have longer statute of limitations periods. So, you know, probably a general, I think we see most companies tend to have, what, a 5 to 7 year document retention policy, just to be careful. But again, on like the credit card information, there's no real need to keep that mm-hmm. beyond a trip that I can personally think of or I've seen in the literature. Very good point.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. It could be other. It seems to be, although I actually had a case recently that was where that exact situation happened. Very often, if there's any type of injury or serious injury, there's probably a good chance that the suit will be brought right away. But we got a weird one involving the monsters. It was a ride in San Francisco down at the Metreon, where a kid was claiming, and he was representing himself, and he was now 20, and supposedly the injury happened when he was 14, and he was bringing a suit on his own, and it was a very bizarre situation, but it was brought timely because that period, or the statute of limitations had told during that period. Luckily, our client was the wrong entity, and he had sued the wrong entity, so we got out, but he ended up suing somebody else, and I'll have to see what happened. Very odd suit. And very odd plaintiff, but we've all dealt with those.
Yeah.
And odd travelers sometimes. Any other questions? Well, thank you so much. And if you do have questions, please don't hesitate to come up and talk to us or email us. We'd be glad to help out. Thank you.